Tonight, Parley Bear is a man looking for big bucks in the form of some bonds. His deceased aunt has given uncooperative survivors pieces to a $300,000 puzzle map. And the question is, will they knock each other off looking for those pieces that lead them to the 300 grand? Our story is called Where There's a Will. It's a case for Philip Marlowe from October 17th, 1948.
When the will was read, everybody figured she'd been crazy when she wrote it. And that included me. But I changed my mind after spending a night on an island with a pig, a cat, and an ape. Because in reality, they were people.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character as CBS presents The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. Now, with Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's unusual story, Where There's a Will.
I had spent the whole day on a noisy job which had concerned itself with a lot of people who talked a lot and said nothing. When I finally locked up my office for the night, I was worn out. As I drove slowly along the street, I was glad to be heading for home and little peace and quiet. At least that's what I thought. But when I pulled up for a full stop sign, only a half a block from my apartment, something happened which brought my little dream of peace and quiet to an end. A car door opposite me flew open and something mighty excited jumped in.
I'm being followed. Drive on, please.
The law?
No, please drive on.
Okay, lady, get a good grip on the upholstery. That ought to do it. Now, what's the... Say, you look a little pale and beautiful.
I'm always pale when my heart's in my mouth.
Well, then why don't you swallow once, take a deep breath, and tell me who was after you?
There isn't much to tell. It was a nasty little man, that's all I know. So thanks for making like Barney Oldfield, and good night.
Hey, not so fast. It's impolite to hitch and run.
Look, mister, right now I'm up to my earrings in trouble, and that leaves very little time for small talk with strangers. Even nice ones.
Well, in that case, the name is Philip Marlowe, which takes care of the stranger part, and I'm a private detective, which makes trouble my business. Where do we go from there?
No place. $300,000 worth of hidden bonds, a screwy old lady and a sculptor with a red beard are too much for any one-man police force, Mr. Marlowe. So again, good night.
Before I could say anything, she was out and gone. There was only the heady scent of taboo in the air. And the memory of a gorgeous profile with jet black hair and pale blue eyes. I sighed like a schoolboy and decided to put her under the heading of things that pass in the night. But I couldn't. Why, out of all the cars in Los Angeles, should she have picked on mine? Well, the next morning, as I was walking down the corridor to my office door, I was still seeing pale blue eyes. Maybe that's why I didn't notice the man who waited outside my door until I was almost on top of him. He was well-dressed and about 35. He looked like a man who had forgotten how to smile.
Marlowe.
Right.
I want to compliment you on your behavior last night, Mr. Marlowe. Barbara told me about it.
Oh? Come on in, Mr.
Shields. Edward Shields. Would you be interested in aiding three people in a search for more than $250,000 in negotiable bonds, 1% of which will be yours if the bonds are found?
Being a fairly fast man with figures, yes. Yes, I would.
Splendid.
I'd like a few details.
Well, Mr. Marlowe, my aunt, Bernice Mayhew Shaw, died, leaving her entire fortune to charity, with the exception of the bonds I mentioned. Those are to be divided equally among three of us, the sole heirs, if we find them within 24 hours.
That sounds like something you dream about after a midnight snack of pizza and pig's knuckles.
Perhaps, but you didn't know my aunt. Beside myself, the beneficiaries are Barbara Haynes, the girl you met last night. She was Aunt Bernice's personal secretary. And another nephew, Harlan Crane, who, at the moment, happens to be a sculptor.
Happens to be?
6 months ago, he was a sailor. Before that, a writer. Without even a rejection slip to his name. my cousin as irresponsible, impetuous, and completely self-indulgent.
The will itself, Mr. Shields. What are the exact conditions?
At precisely noon today, the three of us are to meet with Luther Willard, my beloved aunt's lawyer, who will give us each a large sheet of tissue paper covered with specific markings. Individually, the sheets mean absolutely nothing. But combined, one over the other, the transparent sheets form a coherent map to the location of the bonds.
But why all the intrigue?
My dear departed aunt had a peculiar sense of humor. In addition to this, she was never particularly fond of any of us. She was sure that our individual shortcomings would make cooperation among us impossible, even for so short a period as 24 hours.
And the fact that a man followed Miss Haynes last night convinced you that there was something to that, huh?
Convinced me? No, he may have been nothing but a purse snatcher. Nevertheless, I do feel that to play safe, a fourth party, a custodian of the map, so to speak, would be advisable.
That's fine. When do I go to work, Mr. Shields?
At noon, at the lawyer's office. However, I regret that first you must be approved by the third heir. I don't like to ask this, Mr. Marlowe, but would you mind very much calling on my cousin, Harlan, personally?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think he might prove very interesting.
Yes, I am sure he will. As interesting as an ape in the zoo.
I felt like saying, look, Shields, I'm not as gullible as I look. But then I thought a client's a client, and I decided to play along. Harlan Crane, 6 foot, red-bearded giant, talked as he worked, wielding a 10-pound sculptor's mallet like it was an 18th-century quill.
I'll be frank with you, Marlowe. Money isn't everything to me and never has been. Over $100,000 will buy a lot of marble.
Half the state of Vermont, I'd say. But come here to the point, Mr. Crane. Do I get your seal of approval?
Oh, I imagine you'll be all right. Anyone who can get by Shields, the all-American Scrooge, ought to do.
Thanks, a million.
I'm not being personal where you're concerned. It's just a matter of facing a fact bluntly. Edward Shields is conniving, avaricious, and dull. I heartily recommend him to nobody.
And the girl, Barbara, you feel the same way about her?
No, I don't. And the truth of the matter, Marlowe, is that I know very little about Barbara Haynes. But what I do know, I like very much.
Yeah, that I can understand.
Marlowe, do you realize that once you have the whole map in your possession, you're worth an awful lot of money?
Of course I do. The whole map, I have a market value of exactly $300,000.
That's right, fellow. $300,000, dead or alive.
I know it was small of me, but I didn't exactly see the joke. And things got less funny as time went on. Later, as me and my trio got off the elevator at the lawyer's office, old Luther Willard, Aunt Bernice's attorney, was waiting for us, so excited he could hardly talk.
I've been held up.
What?
A little man. He wanted the map.
A little man? Dark complexion?
Yes, yes. Had a scar on the side of his neck.
Are the maps all right?
Hmm? The maps? Oh, yes, yes, they're all right.
Now, wait a minute, everybody. Give him a chance. Mr. Willard, tell us exactly what happened.
This is Mr. Marlowe. We told you about him, Mr. Willard.
Of course, yes, yes. Come into my office. You see, I was putting some papers into my safe when this little man stepped up behind me and demanded the maps.
Were they in the safe?
No, thank heavens. Make yourselves comfortable.
The
please.
Maps, Mr. Willard, where are they now?
Well, right here, where they were all the time. Here under the blotter on my desk. Clever of me, wasn't it? Wax seals, still intact.
I'll take all three of them right now, Mr. Willard. That is, if there are no objections. All right, then I guess we can be on our way.
Hold on, Mr. Marlowe. There are still two things you people must know. First, in the event the bonds are not recovered within the 24 hours, I am instructed to open another sealed envelope, which I am happy to report is kept in my bank vault. That envelope contains a complete and simplified map and is to be turned over to a designated charity. And second, if any of you die before the allotted time is up, the bonds are to be divided among the surviving persons.
And if none of us survives, Mr. Willard...
Why, in that case, the bonds again go to charity. You see, Harlan, your aunt was a very generous woman.
After arranging to meet with the three heirs at Shields' place later that afternoon, I headed for the nice and public library, where I figured I'd be able to examine the maps in safety.
By placing the three maps exactly one over the other, I saw that the bonds were hidden on the larger of two squares of land called Twin Islands, which were the personal property of the late Bernice Mayhew Shaw, and located in Indian Lake in the San Bernardino Mountains. As I left the library with the three maps in my pocket, I felt like a well-fed mallard on the opening day of hunting season. And then I knew I was being followed. As I slipped into a doorway and turned, I saw it was the nasty little man with the scar.
All right, you, we're through playing tag.
Oh, let me go.
Not yet, Shorty, not until you talk loud and clear.
No, no, don't hit me, please. Please let me down, I'll tell you everything.
All right. If you're sure you can get it all straight the first time. There. Now, the whole story, beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah. Yeah, like you say, whole story. Okay. Starts. Like this!
By the time I figured out that it had been the sawed-off end of a broomstick that had slammed my stomach up against my backbone, the little man was out of sight. Another 5 minutes went by before I quit calling myself sucker and I started to think straight. Nearest public locker was in the Santa Fe Trailways bus depot on Cahuenga. I went up there and deposited 2/3 of the map for safekeeping until we were ready to leave for Indian Lake. And I found a telephone, and a half a dozen calls later, I knew that a caretaker named Jumbo was the sole inhabitant of Twin Islands, and my last call was to him. I wanted some kind of a welcoming committee ready for us. When I left the phone booth, it was only 1 o'clock. So I returned to my apartment where I figured I'd rest until 3, when we were all to meet at Shields' place. But that was my second mistake. Because the moment I closed my apartment door, I was positive I wasn't going to get much rest. I had an unannounced visitor.
Yeah, you look surprised, Mr. Marlowe.
I am. I didn't recognize you at first without your broomstick.
Yeah, I traded that in on this 22 target pistol here. It's more expensive, but it's better. It makes me as big as you are. Maybe bigger.
Yeah, but how much does it do for your personality?
Quite a bit. Gives me poise. And poise gives me manners. So in asking for that map in your pocket, I'll even say please. Come on, Marlowe, I won't say please twice.
No, I don't think you would. Here.
Thank you. Now, before I go, one more thing. The hall outside here is straight and narrow, right to the stairs, and that makes it fine for shooting. So after I step out, don't do anything rash. For a while.
So, loving life as I do, I didn't do anything rash for a while. In fact, I could have whipped up a nice 7-minute frosting before I moved at all. And I phoned the three heirs to get together at my apartment. When I finally had them all seated in front of me, I related the saga of the little man, including my premonition that one of the three present was signing his paychecks. Of course, I got nothing but Cupid doll innocence out of any of them. So after adding that we'd get underway just as soon as the missing 1/3 of the map was returned to me, I threw my trench coat over my arm and told them I was going for a walk. But before leaving them, I reminded them that whoever was behind the little man could fire him, because I would never have kept all three maps in one place anyway, unless all of the heirs were on hand to watch one another. And then I left. I hadn't walked more than a half a block up Franklin when I stopped at the sound of Barbara running after me.
Phil, I'm scared. Harlan and Shields are acting like a couple of wild men, calling each other every name under the sun.
What'd you expect? Chit-chat about the weather? Now quit acting like a bobby soxer within squealing distance of Sinatra and try a cigarette. It'll calm your...
What is it, Phil? Why are you smiling like that? What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong, Barbara, nothing. It's just that I found this in the pocket of my trench coat when I went for my cigarettes.
It's the map.
That's right. The missing third. It's back already. When that missing third part of the map turned up so fast, I figured the heirs had decided to play ball. But I made a mental note to keep my eyes on them anyway. At 3 o'clock, I went to Edward Shields' hillside house in Laurel Canyon for the scheduled meeting. Shields wasn't home yet, but Cousin Harlan was there, admiring the view. Barbara showed up a few minutes later in a convertible, and Shields arrived last by cab. It finally began to look as though we might actually start out all together.
Well,
I see we all arrived safe and sound.
Yeah. Disappointed?
Only by your clumsy attempts at humor, Harlan.
Stop it, boys. Let's get started. Phil, have you looked at the map? Where are we going?
To Indian Lake. It's a 4-hour drive, so if you're all ready, I suggest we get started.
Very well. I'll go up to the garage and get the car.
So Aunt Bernice hid the bonds in a roost at Twin Islands, eh? Well, well, well.
Nobody seemed surprised at the location Aunt Bernice had chosen to hide her bonds. In Holland, Barbara and I stood on the front porch watching Shields as he climbed the very steep driveway to his garage in the car. But Barbara got more of my attention than Shields. Ah, she made a mighty dreamy picture. And she leaned casually back against the rail of the porch. She wasn't aware that I was watching her. And I suddenly saw her go tense, her eyes filled with fear, and I quickly turned to follow her stare. Shields' car was going at a rapid clip down the steep driveway. I still couldn't figure out Barbara's concern, and then she started screaming.
The car's out of control.
The car was headed for the edge of a cliff.
His brakes are out.
He'll go over. The tree stopped him.
Shields, are you hurt?
No, I'm all right. The brakes, I tried to stop
him. He hadn't hit that tree.
You'd have gone over the edge.
Let's have a look at those brakes, Shields. Well, no wonder.
What is it?
Brake line's broken. Every drop of fluid drained out.
I might have been killed.
No might about it, Shields. We stood there for a while, all looking at one another, but nothing was said. Brake lines rarely snap accidentally. And I remembered that Harlan had been at Shields' house early, and the car had been in the garage, and Barbara... Well, I had to admit that she actually had anticipated the car going out of control. Well, the 24 hours for finding the bonds were slipping by, and I knew we had to get to Indian Lake. We held a short powwow without passing the peace pipe, and we decided to take Barbara's car. We picked up the rest of the map, which I'd checked at the bus station, and we shoved off. After a 4-hour drive that was about as relaxing as the thought of an overdue time bomb in a day nursery, we finally pulled up to the shores of Indian Lake. Jumbo, the caretaker, was waiting at the dock. He knew how to handle a boat, and a few minutes later, we could see Twin Islands. We headed for the smaller of the two, where I could make out a rambling lodge. The other island, a quarter of a mile away, seemed deserted. Shields was the first one ashore.
Here, Barbara, let me help you.
Run along, boy. I'll help Barbara.
Thanks, Harlan. Well, Marlo, what now?
Well, first we go up to the house. Oh, Jumbo, you got everything ready for us? Hey, Jumbo.
Huh? Sure. Everything's ready, Mr. Marlo. Just like you said, I opened 4 of the upstairs rooms.
Open the rooms? We're not going to sleep out here, are we?
I'm going to try.
But this isn't a vacation. We're here to find the bonds and get out. You realize it's almost 9 already?
That leaves us just 15 hours, Marlowe.
Yeah, I know. I got a good watch and I count to 24, and I'm also giving orders to
you
three.
Don't get high-handed, Marlowe. You're an employee of ours, and that's all. Let's get the map together and start looking for those bonds right now.
Take it easy, big man. The bonds are hidden on the other island. The map is as tangled as a second-hand spider web. We wouldn't get anything at all down in the dark.
That's your opinion.
Look, you people hired me to help you find those bonds. If I have to get nasty to make you take orders, I can do that, too. Now let's play like we're smart and go up to the lodge and relax.
All right, Marlo. But remember, we'd better have those bonds by tomorrow, or someone else will be nasty. Very nasty. And I mean me.
What? You too? Getting the three heirs settled down at dinner table was quite a chore. And when I was sure they'd keep an eye on each other, I slipped outside. I hid 1/3 of the map in a drain pipe. Then I went upstairs to my room, and I hid another 1/3 in the window shade. Now, the maps were settled, and I began to think about other things, like the accident to Shields' car. And there were too many accidents and coincidences to suit me. So I decided to drop in on Cousin Holland's room to see what I could see. After 15 fruitless minutes, I was about to leave when something in the wastebasket caught my eye. The corner of a half-hidden handkerchief monogrammed HC. I had just picked it up when I saw Jumbo standing in the open door.
That handkerchief there in your hand, that blood on it?
No. No, it looks more like brake fluid. And in this case, it's practically the same thing, huh? I think we'll leave it right here in the wastebasket, Jumbo. Oh, did you want something?
Just wanted to say I'll be in my own place out back if you want me.
Okay. You know where Mr. Shields is?
He's out in the veranda.
Alone?
Yeah.
Thanks, Jumbo. If I need anything, I'll call you. Good night. Shields.
Oh, it's you, Marlowe. What's wrong?
You sound like a man expecting trouble.
I was nearly killed in my car this afternoon, and I don't think that was the end of it.
Yeah, and don't stand too close to high windows.
Thank you. It's comforting to know that I am not alone in my suspicions.
Maybe, how are you betting? On the beauty or the beast?
Don't be absurd. I hope someday to marry Barbara.
Yeah? Well, a guy might be beating your time right now with a sculptor's mallet.
You may be naive, Mr. Marlowe, but Barbara isn't. I saw them just a moment ago walking down to the boathouse. Harlan's galloping after her like a half-baked idiot, as usual. But if Miss Haynes prefers me, what can he do about it?
There was an answer for that, but it seemed a little obvious under the circumstances. Well, a few minutes later, Shields went inside, and I made a beeline for the boathouse to water down a certain hot-headed sculptor named Harlan. When I got within earshot, I knew I'd be as welcome as whooping cough at a glassblower's convention. So I stopped and listened.
Barbara, darling, I'm falling in love with you. You know that, don't you? Let me hold you close.
Harlan, Oh, Harlan.
This is real, Barbara. For the first time in my life, I'm truly in love. I want to do things for you, make you happy.
Please wait. I'm not completely free. There are still ties with Edward, you know.
Shields. That fat, stingy Babbitt. He's no man for you. Why, if he so much as touches you from now on... Wait a minute, Barbara. Marlowe, you cheap snooping eavesdropper.
Eavesdropping's a minor vice compared to some of the shenanigans going on around here.
Just what do you mean by that?
A word to the wise is sufficient. You, I'll give a few more. Now, somebody's trying to cut our little triangle down to two sides before noon tomorrow. What I've seen so far, I don't like, so I'm warning everybody.
Just what are you accusing me of? Why,
Harlan, stop it. Don't be a fool. Will you cavemen control yourselves until those bonds are found? Come on, Harlan, let's go in. Good night, Marlowe. Don't get your head caught in any transoms.
Deciding sleep wouldn't be very healthy for a man in my position, I decided to sit up that night. It was about 2 o'clock when I looked out the window and saw something mighty interesting. A light was moving on the other island opposite us. I got hold of John Moore and we went over there as fast as we could.
Yeah, we're beach. That light's dead ahead, Mr. Marlowe. Looks to me like it's up on the picnic shelter.
Yeah, I'll see you later, John Moore. Guess who?
Oh, Marlowe. I didn't hear you come up. Wind's too strong, I guess. I'm glad to see you. Spooky here all alone.
Oh, sure, sure. What's the idea? Decide to do a little freelance prospecting?
Oh, that's right. Bernice Mayhew loved this spot, and I had a hunch she hid the bonds here on the base of this table. Oh, I guess I was wrong. Oh, come on, Marlowe. Limber up. You can't blame me for trying.
Listen, beautiful, don't flap your eyelashes at me. I can't see anything but double crosses right now. All right, if you've had your fun, let's go back to the lodge.
Don't be that way, Phil. Phil, the sun will be coming up in 2 or 3 hours. Why not wait for it here with me?
Barbara, baby, don't burn up too many calories with that routine. Because I only keep 1/3 of the map on me.
You think you're so smart.
Bright ideas hatching that cute little brain of yours, too. Now let's... Oh, comes the gun with a pearl handle, no less.
Stay away from me, Marlowe. Over there.
Hey, what's going on here, anyway?
Jumbo!
Look out, Jumbo! Jumbo stepped into the light and Barbara turned. I made a swipe at a gun hand that knocked pistol, purse, and lamp all over the picnic shelter. I found the gun and gave it to Jumbo. Then I started to pick up an assortment of knickknacks that had spilled out of a purse. But I never finished, because one of the items made my eyes pop. It was the monogrammed handkerchief covered with brake fluid that I'd found in Harlan's room. It all made sense now. It tied up everything that I'd suspected right along. Only two of my trio had planned to split up the $300,000 worth of bonds from the first. As I ran for the motor launch, I yelled at Jumbo to bring Barbara over in the rowboat. All the way back, I had the panicky feeling that I was probably too late. But when I sneaked in the front door of the lodge, there were still two voices, and they came from the open kitchen door. My hand on my gun, I edged along the wall and peeked in.
Shields, you're a fool.
Perhaps. But I'm going to kill you and have a perfect case of self-defense.
What are you talking about?
You're hopelessly framed, cousin Harlan. I ruined the brakes on my own car. I planted your handkerchief. stained with brake fluid in your room. Marlowe found it. He's convinced that you tried to kill me. He's also convinced that he was brought into this whole thing by coincidence. He doesn't know that he was deliberately involved in our search for the bonds, just so he'd make a reputable witness.
You're out of your mind.
Not at all. I'm going to kill you and say it was self-defense. Marlowe will testify that you tried to kill me before.
What Marlowe's going to do is blow your head off if you don't drop that gun, Shields.
Marlowe?
Yeah, Marlowe. Who knows, he wasn't brought into this thing by coincidence, but has stuck around to see the fireworks and almost saw them just now.
Bill, what's happened?
Barbara, couldn't you hold Marlowe on the other island? You
shut up, Shields! Barbara's little mistake was that she should have gotten rid of Holland's handkerchief after she took it out of his room so he wouldn't see it.
Barbara, I don't understand. You planned all this with Shields against me?
Well, I did in the beginning, Harlan, but I changed my mind when I fell in love with you. I let Marlowe find the handkerchief in my purse. I wanted him to stop Edward. Oh, darling, don't you
see... Come on, Miss Bankhead, cut the dramatics. The show's over. Let's have it straight, huh?
All right. We might as well if we're going to find those bonds before it's too late. Edward and I did plan it. We even hired the little man who tried to get the maps from you.
And when that didn't work, you planned to get rid of Holland and split the 300 grand.
So we failed. So what? We're right back where we started. 100,000 apiece. Now let's go find those bonds.
Not so fast, beautiful. What happened to Holland just now was a little more serious than a hot foot. It was attempted murder. He can slap you two in the jug this minute if he wants to. But I'll leave it up to him. Okay, Holland, what do you say? It's your move.
No. I've got a better idea. Marlowe, 1/3 of that map is mine. Give it to me.
Okay. There it is.
Harlan, what are you going to do?
Harlan, no. Don't burn it.
There. Now we all lose. Now none of us will get the bonds. That's probably how Aunt Bernice wanted it anyway.
It was almost noon. I was standing on the veranda of the lodge, and a scrawny old crow was perched up on the roof. I saw Barbara and Shields quietly pull away in a boat with Jumbo. And I saw Holland lumbering off to the far end of the island to sulk. And as I watched the three of them, I couldn't help thinking. A pig in a pinstripe suit, an ape with a red beard, and an alley cat in nylon. Yeah. Keep laughing, Aunt Bernice. You were right. Greed, treachery, and rashness don't mix, even for 24 hours. And the 1% of the bonds I was to get? Well, that's my contribution to charity. Who knows? Maybe I can take it off my income tax.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler, stars Gerald Moore and is produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. Featured in tonight's story were Mary Shipp, Parley Bear, Don Diamond, Ted Von Eltz, and Wilms Herbert. The special music was conceived and conducted by Richard Orant. Be sure to be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
When I got the crisp $50 bill in advance, I figured my client had a heart of gold. But after I was beat up, double-crossed, and shot at, I realized just how hard a heart of gold could be.
Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, John Dixon Carr, three great names in the world of mystery and thrills. One down, two to go today on CBS. Now that you've heard Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe in action, CBS invites you to hear Dashiell Hammett's Sam Spade in action tonight, followed by John Dixon Carr's personally written radio series, Cabin B-13. Chandler, Hammett, Carr, today and every Sunday, over most of these CBS stations. It's a mystery if you miss them. Roy Rowan speaking for CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Philip Marlowe with a puzzling case. The story of where there is a will. And there was a will to bail out of the whole thing, as it turned out. Nobody got anything. So great was the disgust of that one heir who burns his part of the map, puts the stop to the whole thing. One of the cases for Philip Marlowe, it came from October 17th, 1948. Next, Quiet Please, as old-time radio drama continues on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The modest name of tonight's story is The Evening and the Morning. And a widow asks a man in love with her for a very special favor. This is Quiet Please from November 14th, 1948, with The Evening and the Morning.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please. The American Broadcasting Company presents Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper, which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet, Please, for today is called The Evening and the Morning.
They're all gone now, aren't they? That was the last car going out the gate, wasn't it? There's nobody there but the gravediggers. Can we walk over there for a minute? Please. It's getting dark, isn't it? Is that what's bothering you? There isn't anything here that'll hurt you. My grandfather always taught me not to be afraid of cemeteries. They're sad places, he always said. They're sad and they're lonesome. But there's nothing there to harm you. I'll only be a minute, really. I'm not going to break down or anything like that. There's something I have to do. No, I won't run away. You're not worried about that, are you? Well, after all, you've got a gun. You could shoot me if I tried to run away. I couldn't very well attack you suddenly, could I? Not with these handcuffs. Of course not. So let's walk over there for just a minute. Please?
Don't you think you're overdoing it a little bit, Dean?
Well, I'm sorry if you think so.
I do think so.
Please, may we walk over to the grave?
Listen here. You don't have to impress me, you know. I was good enough to bring you out here and take the responsibility for you.
And I'm very grateful to you for that, Mr. Thorpe.
You know, if some of her friends had seen you here, you'd have stood a good chance of getting lynched.
I know that.
I was sympathetic, and I listened to you, and it was against my better judgment that I brought you out here.
I'm more than grateful, Mr. Thorpe. If I could have come out here alone, I would have.
We haven't started letting confessed murderers run around loose yet, especially to attend the funerals of the people they've killed.
May we walk over to the grave, please?
Oh, come on.
Thank you.
You're not doing yourself any good this way, Dean.
I'm not trying to, Mr. Thorpe.
What do you want to see the grave for? How can you stand looking at it? Haven't you got any heart at all?
I killed her, didn't I?
They won't have any trouble hanging you for it.
I expect that.
Well, what do you want, then? Why do you...
This isn't easy, Mr. Thorpe. It was hard enough doing what I did. And coming out here... Well, it has to be done.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I loved Alice, Mr. Thorpe.
You did?
I did.
And you murdered her. Here, where are you going?
A flower, that's all. I want a flower from her grave.
Put that back.
No. No, I won't put it back, Mr. Thorpe.
I tell you...
No, please don't ask me to put it back. This is a very precious thing, this flower.
What are you talking about?
Why, this is why I murdered Alice, Mr. Thorpe. It's very good of you to walk back with me instead of riding. It's really a great favor, Mr. Thorpe, and I might as well tell you, Well, I would have insisted on walking if you hadn't agreed so readily. Insisted. You see, if you hadn't consented, I'd have just stayed there. And it would have been awkward for you because I think I'm stronger than you and I could have resisted you. I don't believe you would have used your gun. Even if you had threatened me, I wouldn't have moved. So I'm very grateful to you. Because it's important for me to walk back.
It's the last walk in the open air you're likely to have.
Yes. I suppose it is.
You're a strange character, Dean.
Well, you're rather unusual yourself, sir. Walking peacefully down a dark road with a murderer all alone.
You may not have noticed that I've got my hand in my coat pocket.
So you have.
And in my coat pocket is a gun.
Of course.
So let's not get any ideas because I've been stupid enough to humor you a little.
I have no intention of trying to escape.
Thank you.
Did you ever walk along the cemetery road before?
No.
I have. I know every inch of it.
Morbid.
No. The first time was with Alice.
The woman you killed?
Yes. I walked back with her from her husband's funeral a year ago.
So now you're walking back from hers. Did you kill him, too?
Why, no. Don't you remember? He was killed in a motor accident.
Oh, yes. Francis, that was his name.
Francis. Yes.
Were you, in love with Alice then?
I think I've always been in love with Alice.
I see.
But Alice loved Francis.
I begin to see a motive now.
Motive?
For murdering her. She was still in love with her husband. She wouldn't have you, so you killed her.
No.
What?
No, that wasn't my motive.
What was then?
I remember walking along this same road, Alice and I, a year ago. Just a year ago, day before yesterday. It was the same kind of evening, too. Cold and misty. Threatening snow like it is now. We'd stayed there at the cemetery after everybody else had gone, Alice and I. And now we were coming back home.
Francis would have liked the flowers, wouldn't he, Dean?
Yes.
So many, many flowers. Such beautiful ones. So bright and lovely. And the cold rain on them. Soon the snow.
Alice.
Francis and the flowers. All alone. Dean, let's go back for a little while, can't we?
No, we mustn't do that, Alice, dear.
Just come to me, Dean. I'm alone. This time I've thought I couldn't help thinking that it's some ghastly joke. That Francis isn't really dead. It's a dream, maybe. Now, oh, Dean, he is dead. And I'm alone.
Liz, dear, don't. We've got to face it, you.
Francis is dead. All I've got left is a flower from his grave.
Alice, you're not alone. I'm... Well, I know I'm not. But you're not alone while I'm... Alice, you're not alone.
Look, Dean. The little yellow flower. The little yellow moss rose that Francis always loved so much. He was born and he lived and he loved me and I loved him and now there's nothing left but this.
Alice, will you listen to me? Alice, will you stop this? It's no good carrying home a flower from there. Why, it's just a little symbol. It'll break your heart all over again every time you look at it.
But it was from his...
No, don't say it. Don't carry home any reminders from that place, dear. I know this is hard, but now is the time for you to make decisions now and not years from now when you should be forgetting. That little rose, it'll always remind you. It'll always hurt you. It'll do terrible things to you, Alice. Throw it away.
Throw away Francis' flower?
It isn't his flower, Alice.
But I need something to remind me.
Do you need anything to remind you of Francis, Alice? You have your memories of 5 years of being married to him. You have all the things he wrote, the music he loved. You have so many precious memories, dear. You're going to trade them all for a memory of a mound of flowers on a November day in the rain.
Why, I remember Francis when he came home from the war.
And the day you were married, I remember.
He was so tall.
I remember both of you.
And the time we went to Canada, and it snowed.
You remember Francis, not the flower.
And the springtime in the country with him. And the times he helped me wash the dishes.
Throw the flower away, Alice.
Here, Dean. You throw it away for me. I want to, but I'm afraid. Throw it away, Dean. And let me keep Francis in my heart.
There's an old elm tree beside the road, the biggest old elm tree you ever saw. We'll be walking past it in a few minutes. I'll show it to you, Mr. Thorpe.
You certainly talk as if you loved that woman, Dean.
I did love her. I do love her.
Well, why did you kill her then?
Because I loved her. And because she loved Francis.
I said that was it.
No. You're right in what you said, but you're forming the wrong conclusions, Mr. Thorpe.
How?
You think that I murdered her in a fit of anger because she refused to marry me.
Of course.
Well, that isn't true.
I don't understand you.
I'll explain it all to you.
It doesn't need much explaining to me.
I'll explain it.
Well, what happened? Did your idea about throwing away the flower work?
Yes, of course.
But you're carrying away a flower from her grave.
Yes.
Why?
Perhaps I want my memories of Alice to be that grave out there in the rain.
Adding to your own punishment.
Yes, yes, that's part of it. I realize that I must pay a price for what I've done. I do that gladly. And I mean that. I mean, I'm really glad to pay it. But I hope you will believe me. I want to punish myself even more. But I haven't finished. I've got one more thing to do. That's why I begged you to let me come to the funeral. And why I plucked the flower from her grave.
You're over my head, Dean.
Well, bear with me, Mr. Thorpe. It's only a little while. There, that's the big elm tree I told you about. You see it? There's a little street light just beyond it.
What about it?
There's a bus stop just beyond it. We can wait there for a bus if you like.
Yes, I see somebody waiting there now. I think it's a good idea. I'm tired. I wish you'd tell me, though, why you did do it, Dean. Not that it'll make any difference. Not with your confession and all that.
Mr. Thorpe, are you superstitious?
Me? No. It's nonsense.
No, it isn't nonsense. A great many superstitions are founded on fact. A great many.
I don't believe in ghosts, if that's what you mean.
You know, Francis was a writer.
Yes?
A writer of supernatural stories.
I didn't know that.
He had a very thorough understanding of superstitions, beliefs of all kinds. He had a large library of source material on that subject.
Did he believe in ghosts?
He was a rational man, Mr. Thorpe. And my very good friend.
All right.
I saw a good deal of Alice in the years since Francis was killed. In the first few months when she was having to reconstruct her life, when she was having to reconcile herself to the fact that she was alone, that Francis was gone out of her world. I spent a good deal of time with her. And I was gratified that she was taking it very well. She did the house over completely, with the exception of the room he'd used for study. That she left exactly as he'd left it. typewriter, stack of paper, the pottery jar full of sharpened pencils, half a pack of cigarettes and a torn match package. Even the wastebasket cramped full of torn sheets of paper, exactly the way he left it. That, she said, was to be her living memory of Francis. And always when I came to visit her, we sat in Francis' study. Talk was mostly of him.
His publishers called today and wondered what about the book he was working on.
What about it?
I told him it wouldn't be finished.
He only had a few pages to go, as I remember it.
It won't be finished.
I don't think you ought to do that, Alice.
I want it that way, Dean.
Do you still feel... I mean...
I'm very glad you made me throw away that flower. That's what you mean. It was an ugly thing, bringing it away from there.
Yes.
I'm very content now. It's been hard to make myself realize that... You know, it's not really so bad when there are people around. But at night, alone by myself, I think I've cried myself out, Dean.
I'm glad you're...
You've been an angel.
Well...
You have.
Well, you see, Alice, I love you.
I know you do.
I... Well, that's all I can say, Alice. I love you. It's a horrible thing to have to say to the widow of my best friend, but...
Widow?
Well, Alice...
Widow, you said.
But Alice...
You call me his widow. I'm not.
Darling.
No. Get away from me. I'm not his widow. Do you hear me? I'm Francis' wife.
Where's that fellow that was waiting for the bus? Did he go away? Did you see him?
Yes, I saw him.
So she did get mad at you, huh? Well, don't you think you were rushing things a little, Dean? Don't you think you should have waited a little longer before you put in a word for yourself with his widow?
His wife. No, Mr. Thorpe, I always knew that Alice would never marry me. I knew too much of the deep love and affection that existed between those two. And I knew that I would never have a chance with her. But in all honesty, I couldn't help confessing to her.
She said she knew how you felt.
Yes. She did.
Well, I don't see where this story's getting us, Dean. Besides, here's your tree, and I'm going to sit down and wait for a bus. Wonder where that other fellow went.
Francis loved music, although he couldn't play a note. Alice in the old days would sit at the piano nights when he found himself struggling with an idea that wouldn't come out. Francis always said that if he could listen to Alice playing long enough, the tougher situation would unravel itself. I think that was a fact. Many a night I've sat in the living room listening to her at the piano while Francis listened from his study. I remember one thing he used to love. Alice played it so often for him, people used to laugh and call it their theme song. And one night, not very long ago, I dropped in to see Alice. After a while, she sat down at the piano and played it. I hadn't heard it for so long. Sounds wonderful to me.
I felt so lonesome tonight.
It's an unpleasant night.
Like it was a year ago, out there and...
You weren't going to think of that.
I can't help it, Dean.
Play something else.
No. I wonder if Francis is lonesome, too.
Alice.
No. I've been dreaming about him, Dean.
Well, I suppose that's natural.
He's always trying. trying to tell me something. It's so vague. But he's lost. And he wants me so.
You're morbid tonight.
No. No, I'm not, Dean. I thought I was getting over missing Francis, Dean. But I'll never get over it. I thought I'd forget him. But I can't forget him.
You must forget him, dear.
No. I won't forget him. He's my husband. I love him. I love him.
Alice, dear, you mustn't know.
Oh, Dean. I want him so. You've never lost anyone, Dean. You don't know how it is. And now, these last few weeks, I know how Francis wants me.
You're not being rational, Alice.
But I love him, Dean. Oh, isn't there some way?
No, Alice.
No, I mean it. Dean, listen.
Well?
Francis had so many books. Wouldn't there be something in one of them that might tell me how to bring Francis back to me?
Alice.
Or some way I could find him, Dean.
Alice, sit down and stop this.
Dean.
Well?
Dean, do you love me?
You know I do.
I'll never marry you.
I hope that someday...
No. It's a sacrilege to think it even. I'm Francis' wife. I'll be Francis' wife forever. Forever and ever.
Oh, darling.
No, wait. Dean, as surely as I'm sitting here, I swear to you I'll always love Francis.
Yes.
And I can't live without him.
What do you mean by that?
I've thought about it. I've thought about it until my head hurts. You think I'm losing my mind, don't you?
No.
Dean, I won't marry you.
Yes, you said that.
But do you want to earn my everlasting gratitude? And Francis' gratitude, too?
I don't understand you.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
I won't do it.
Dean, listen. If I kill myself, that'll be a sin, won't it?
Yes.
And I won't go to heaven and be with Francis,
no.
Will I? Then will you do it?
Alice, you've lost your mind.
No.
You
said you loved me. Then prove it. Give me back to Francis.
That's a great story, Dean. That's a great story.
Yes, it is. Isn't it?
It's not the story you told when they arrested you.
No.
So you shot her because she asked you to?
No.
What do you mean?
I went away from the house that night. I was very disturbed. Sleep? I couldn't sleep. About 3 a.m, I telephoned her. We talked for a long time. She was much calmer. She agreed that she'd been very foolish. And we'd talk it over again later in the day. I took 2 bromides and slept till noon. And then in the afternoon, she telephoned me and woke me up. Come over right away, she said. Come over now. Hurry. When I came in, she was holding a book. She seemed perfectly calm, but had obviously been crying for a long time. She was exhausted. What's happened, Alice? I asked. What's the matter?
Sit down, Dean.
What is it? What's that book?
It's one of Francis' books from his reference library.
Oh.
Dean, when you left last night, I got to thinking some more about what I'd said first. That maybe there was something in one of Francis' books that would tell me how to bring us together again.
Alice, I thought...
Still. I went in there. And I looked at a lot of books. Some of them I couldn't understand. But I found one. I found this one.
What is it?
Dean. You murdered Francis.
I what?
You murdered his soul.
Alice, what are you talking about?
Do you remember the flower from his grave?
Why, yes. Yes, of course.
Look at the book.
Dictionary of Superstitions and Mythology. Bonnaget, Paris, 1927. Well, what about it?
Page 101, I've marked it. Read it.
Flowers. If a flower be plucked from a grave that hath been afterwards thrown away, the place where the flower falls will be haunted. Alice, what is this?
It's true, Dean.
It's superstition, for heaven's sake.
It's true.
Oh, now, come now.
It's true.
How do you know?
Because I went out to the cemetery road, and I went to the elm tree where you threw the flower away almost a year ago.
You went... When did you go out there?
This morning, while it was still dark.
This morning?
And it's true. I know. Francis is there. Chained to that spot forever and ever. Oh, Dean, what are we going to do? We did it, you and I. What are we going to do?
And what did you do?
I did what I thought best.
You mean to say you believe in a stupid superstition? You mean you murdered the woman because of...
I came out here to this tree with Alice, Mr. Thorpe.
You did?
And I knew Francis was here, too. He's here now. You saw him, didn't you? A man you thought was waiting for the bus.
Here, where are you going?
I threw away a flower from his grave here a year ago. Now, here's your flower, Alice. I've kept my promise, dear. Alice and Francis together now. Forever.
You don't believe that.
Listen.
Quiet Please story is The Evening and the Morning. It was written and directed by Willis Cooper. Ernest Chappell was the man who spoke to you.
And Bess Johnson played Alice. Martin Lawrence was Mr. Thorpe. As usual, music for Quiet Please is by Albert Berman. Now for a word about next week, our writer-director Willis Cooper.
Thank you for listening to Quiet Please. For next week, I have a story which I call One for the Book.
And so, until next week at the same time, I am quietly yours, Ernest Chappell.
Now, a listening reminder. A great number of our citizens are unaware of the insidious rackets that are constantly challenging our law enforcement agencies. You can hear about them on David Harding Counterspy. Tune in Counterspy this afternoon on your ABC station. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Definitely a story for Quiet Please. Reflective and, well, bittersweet, I guess you could say. Possibly more bitter than sweet. In The Evening and the Morning. Quiet Please from November 14th, 1948. And our last foray for old-time radio drama for this Sunday night. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next weekend by the glow of your radio from 8 to 11, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.